Welcome to Conservation Federation Podcast, Episode 4. This is Brandon Butler, your host, and today I'm sitting down with outdoor communicating legend Joel Vance. Also joining us is Jim Lowe. Joel, welcome to the podcast.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Brandon.
Well, we appreciate having you. And Jim, thanks for being here with us as well.
That's my pleasure. Anytime I can sit down with Joel, it's always entertaining.
Great. Boy, where to start with Joel Vance? So I guess we got to probably go back to the beginning. You're a native Missourian, and give us the lowdown on the early Joel Vance years.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm not a native Missourian. My dad was, and had lived in a farm, kind of a hard rock farm up in Sheraton County. And back in the 1920s, he and his brother decided that that wasn't the way they wanted to make a living because they weren't making a living. So they lit out for Chicago. And actually, I was born in Chicago and was raised there until I was in the, I guess, 7th or 8th grade. And my dad was offered a promotion to move to New York City. He was a perfume oil salesman, and which is kind of an esoteric occupation. And my mother didn't want to go to New York City, and I certainly didn't. And my dad wasn't crazy about it either. He and his brother had invested in a farm up near Bynumville in Sheraton County, and they decided that they would just take it, pack it in, and move back to their home place in Missouri. So we moved to Dalton, Missouri, and I grew up there and was a Sheraton County boy all through high school and have been a Missourian ever since we moved.
What year did you graduate high school?
In 1952.
And that was a pretty good basketball team.
Well, we had one of the best they've ever had. I don't think they've had a better one since then. We were lucky they reorganized the school districts about that time, and we managed to inherit Gerald Lineman from Salisbury. Kind of stole him away when they redistricted the schools. And Gerald turned out to be an all-stater and wound up being the high scorer at Central College, Central Methodist, and I think still is. I think he still owns scoring records there. So if it hadn't been for Gerald and a couple of other transfers, we probably wouldn't have been the best team around. But we were for that short period.
When you guys weren't playing basketball, what were you doing in Dalton country?
Well, Dalton was, of course, 3 miles north of the cutoff. And anybody that's familiar with that country knows the Dalton cutoff. And this was back in the 1950s, which was duck heaven. In those days, we had probably more ducks than there have been since then. And we used to hunt at the cutoff. And a couple of other guys and I would pick up pecans in the Dalton bottoms for, I don't know, you get a nickel for 10 pounds or something like that. So we'd spend all day picking up pecans. We carried a shotgun with us. And, of course, the ducks were coming back to the cutoff in the evening to roost. And if we were lucky, we'd get a shot at them. We'd drop our pecan sack and pick up a gun and take a shot and probably not hit anything. But, you know, the cutoff was our playground. We skated on it in the wintertime, and we kind of swam in it in the summertime. It was kind of a mud hole, but we swam in it anyway and fished in it, ran trot lines there, and hunted ducks. And, you know, it was a great place to grow up.
Growing up in the outdoors, were you aware at an early age that you wanted to make a career out of outdoor communication or somehow in the outdoor industry?
I was aware that I wanted to communicate. I wanted to be a writer from the get-go. Way back in when I was probably in grade school, wanted to be a writer. That's all I ever wanted to be. And I went to journalism school and started out in newspapers. And I spent 13 years working for newspapers. And the opportunity came up to work for the conservation department. And I'd been as a hunter and a fisherman all through, you know, my newspaper days. And I thought, this is heaven. You know, I'm going to get paid for writing about hunting and fishing. And so I went to the conservation department and spent 21 years there. And I retired in 19, well, I don't know, Jim can tell you because he got the job that I had.
I slipped in behind him. Yeah, that was 1990, December 90. I think you finished up either, you might have finished up in 89. Mm-hmm. But anyway, 89 or 90.
So between the two of us, we've got more than 40 years in with the conservation department.
Yep.
And you know, it was a great thing because I came in at the tail end of the first generation of the legendary biologists that worked for the conservation department. I mean, there were a few that started out when the original constitutional amendment was passed, Harold Terrell was one I can remember, I think was the first biologist hired by the department. But then they got a legendary crew, guys like Charlie Schwartz and John Lewis, and who's still around, and, you know, Dick Vaught, and I could go on and name them, Ken Sadler and Dean Murphy and Mike Molonsky. All these guys were kind of the first generation, and they were the ones that set the standards for biology in this country, not just in Missouri, but all over the country. They were known for establishing the standards of their species that they worked on.
Yep, they laid the data groundwork for scientific wildlife management in the United States and in the world, really.
Yeah, they did. And I was so privileged to work with those guys and you know, gain from, I didn't know anything about biology. That wasn't my major. But I picked it up by osmosis, by hanging around with them. And you know, I used to be a good friend of Bill Bennett, who was the outdoor editor at the St. Joe paper. And Bill summed it up perfectly one time. He said, those guys were the kind of guys that went around with poop on their boots. And, you know, that's so true, because they were out in the field. They didn't learn it through computers because they didn't have computers. What they had was a notebook and a pencil and a pair of binoculars, and they went out and spent endless days in the field, and that's the way they soaked up the knowledge that everybody's operating on today.
Yeah, that era of MDC, you know, for those of us that are historians of conservation in Missouri, looking back upon some of those legendary biologists, like you said, that came up, how blessed were we to have those people in those places? But I think a lot of them would probably argue that they were pretty fortunate to have you along for that ride. Everybody knows that the biology is extremely important, but being able to communicate what's going on to the citizens and to the general public is very important also. And MDC, I think, is head and shoulders above so many other agencies when it comes to communicating that information. And you were right at the center of that for so long.
Well, you know, I think that's an important point. Again, I think we were blessed to have a whole generation of biologists, both fisheries and wildlife and forestry, who not only were biologists, but they were able to write. And if you go back and read the old conservationist magazines from the 1940s and 50s, you find an awful lot of articles that were written by the biologists. And as a communicator, I can read those articles, and they're darn good. You know, I couldn't have done it any better. So these guys knew what they were doing.
Can you give us a few examples of stories that you worked on back in the day that still stand out to you?
Oh, my gosh, there were so many, I don't even know where to start. You know, I spent time with these guys. I'd go out with them, and some of them I can't tell. I think I could tell them in an informal setting, but not on a formal one. But, no, I had a lot of fun. I never regretted one moment of the time I spent with those guys. And, you know, I will tell one, and it's probably embarrassing to the former president of the Federation, Glenn Chambers. Glenn was filming the turkey movie, and he wanted to get a shot of wild turkeys working along the edge of a woods. And so he got several wild turkeys, and he was going to release these turkeys. He had a fence built in the edge of a woods along Highway 63, and he was going to be up on the edge of the highway, and he was going to film these birds after they were let out of cages as they kind of walked along this fence, and he was going to get a great shot. And I just happened to be along with him to see what was going on. So Glenn gave the signal, and his assistants turned the birds loose, and they made about two steps, and all of them flew over the fence, and they were gone into the woods. And I can't repeat what Glenn said, but it was not complimentary.
That's great. There's so many good Glenn Chambers stories out there. I'm sure you got more than that one to tell us.
Oh, Glenn is, I've never met a guy like him. He is full of more energy than any other 47 people I've ever known. You talk about a type A personality, he's AAA all the way.
Yeah, not only physical energy, but creative energy as well. I mean, the man's an artist, he's a filmmaker, he's a wildlife photographer, he's a resource scientist, a researcher, and a communicator par excellence. He's just, Glenn is part of that generation of Renaissance people who worked for the department, they didn't do just one thing. They all were multifaceted and had the freedom, were given the freedom to pursue those many talents. And, you know, you mentioned that the department, its communications program has been good through the years, and that goes back right to the very start. The founders of that agency understood that they had to have the people behind them, and they knew the importance of keeping people informed about what was going on, and they had the wisdom to let people like Joel, who had a creative bent, be creative in their communications so that people actually wanted to read what he wrote. And it was a big part of what has made this agency such a success. And in fact, Joel was instrumental in selling the design for conservation, our sales tax. You wrote practically the whole magazine that laid out that plan, didn't you?
Well, I wrote the words, but all I did was interpret the ideas. That's what the design for conservation was. Each section and division was told to come up with what they'd love to have if this tax would pass. And so they came up with ideas for programs that would benefit everyone, and all I did was put down the words. The only idea that I'd ever brag about that I had something to do with was the idea of nature centers, and actually it wasn't an original idea with me. I think the second article I did for the Conservationist was on a fellow named George Kastner, who was the manager of the Nature Center down at Bennett Spring, the DNR Nature Center. And I went down and interviewed him. And I thought to myself, you know, if we ever get a chance, the department ought to get involved in building nature centers. So when it came time to write the design for conservation, I just included a system of nature centers, and nobody ever took it out.
Thank you. Thought, those are nice
cool.
Nature centers.
The
yeah.
Power of the pen.
Yeah, we appreciate that.
Those worked out. You know, I kept expecting somebody. You say, well, we don't want to do that, or no, it costs too much, or well, we're not involved in that sort of thing. Nobody ever said a word, so it's there. We have a system today.
You know, when I go out and give talks a lot, we bring up the design for conservation sales tax and the importance of protecting it. A lot of people my age aren't aware of what Missouri was like before the design was in place. So I was born in 1979. Really, anybody 40 years old or younger has been spoiled by the benefits of the work you guys did to pass that. Maybe address a little bit what it was like working for the department prior to having the funding to do the things that needed to be done, and then how Missouri really ramped up over the last 40 years since the design's been in place.
It made all the difference in the world, obviously, once that tax passed. What is it, 60% now of the budget of the department? And we have the best finance conservation department in the country, no doubt about it, and one of the best finance departments of any kind in state government in Missouri. But only because people trust the department to do the right thing with the money that they're giving us, because this is, you know, we're essentially like the highway department, which is also constitutionally protected. We're taking money out of people's pockets to do things with. And they trust the department to do the right thing with those. And I remember one time a guy, Jack Ehrschman, was an outdoor writer from Illinois. He came down to do a story on, this was after the tax had passed, maybe 3 or 4 years, came down to do a story on how things were going for Illinois readers. And he said on his way down, he told me and Jim Keefe and some other people that he had stopped several times to get gas and to eat lunch and eat dinner. And he said while he was there, he would ask people, just kind of get in conversation with various people and in these places, and say, tell me about this conservation that's supposed to be pretty good. What do you think of it? He said, man, people just love it. And these are people that had no axe to grind. They could have, if they didn't like it, they would have said so. But they were universally in favor of what we'd done. And, you know, it was not easy to get done, and it didn't pass by a big margin. But I think today, if you put it on the ballot again, it would be passed overwhelmingly because people have been able to see what was accomplished.
And we've seen in recent times the support of such conservation-type sales taxes when we have to renew
the Park Soil and Water Tax, and that just passed with over 80% of the vote. Mm-hmm. So you've got 80% of Missourians voting in favor of this Park Soil and Water Tax, but yet we've still got certain legislators in the Capitol today that are adamant that we eliminate the conservation sales tax.
Well, there's a remedy for that. You just get them out of office. Either that or wait until they get term limited out, which has happened to a couple of them, I guess. But, you know, I've gone down several times to testify and leave statements when these proposals come up to divert the money or do away with it or whatever. And I just want to get up and throttle them, but you can't really do that. But, you know, all I can do is, as a citizen now, a retiree, is to put my voice in and say, you're fools for doing this. And I hark back to maybe would have been about 1980. There was one of the early, very early attempts to overthrow the conservation sales tax, do a repeal amendment. And they had a hearing at the Capitol, which I went to. And at that time, Marlon Perkins, a fellow that did Zoo Parade and various shows for television.
Wild America.
Yeah, Wild America, came down to testify. And he sat up in front of this committee, and I don't remember if it was Senate or House of Representatives, but it was a hearing on the repeal. He sat there and he said, if you do this, you are fools. He said, you've got a program that is unparalleled. It is the best in the country. Don't mess with it. And there wasn't a voice raised, and nobody said anything, and it never got out of committee, and which is what should have happened.
I think you and Jim and myself, we have a pretty good understanding of what's going on at the Capitol, but most people don't. Most people aren't aware of who their elected officials are. They're not aware of who their state rep is, their state senator, and what those people are doing in Jefferson City. And I have to think that anybody that holds a fishing license, and we're a state of 6 million people and 1.2 million people hold a fishing license, would be really concerned to learn that there's legislation being filed year after year after year that would eliminate opportunities to stock our rivers and lakes with fish and to close public properties that we're able to recreate on. The fact that these bills continue to get filed, I mean, it just blows my mind. Like, and not only the negative, but why we don't, as a state legislature, put more emphasis on the economic and intrinsic values of conservation in Missouri and really promote it. Why isn't there just such affection for what we have and using it as a tool to promote our state nationally? I just don't know what's missing from the equation.
Well, it blows my mind, too. You know, tourism and hunting and fishing are the second biggest industry in the state, next to agriculture. So, you know, it's there. The money is, it's an economic thing, and that's generally the argument for doing away with it, is it costs too much, or we can use the money elsewhere for something else that's good. There's always going to be that argument, but it's also pretty hard to argue against economics. And hunting, fishing, outdoors in general brings in more money than anything except agriculture. So how can you argue with it?
Yeah, it's hard to fathom arguing with it, but they seem to find a way every year.
Well, I think the argument that that the money could be better used somewhere else is just a pretext. I think the underlying reason is that it has always bothered the legislature ever since Missourians took control of conservation away from the legislature in 1936. It has bothered the legislature that Conservation Department and its budget are not under their thumb. It's one political tool, one piece of pork that is not available to them to use for political advantage, and it galls them, and they wish that they could get control of it.
Yeah, and some of them seem to stop at nothing to come up with new ways to at least dig a knife in the back of
right.
the entire system.
I want to add, too, that there are plenty of good legislators who understand the value of conservation, and it's thanks to them that those efforts to repeal the sales tax or to attack the Conservation Department's constitutional authority fail. There's good reason for it, and part of it is that some legislators understand the importance of conservation, and others are afraid of their constituents who understand the importance of conservation, and they are afraid of the Conservation Federation that fights like a lion for conservation every year in the legislature.
Yeah, I think it, more than plenty. I think most legislators understand it.
Yep.
It's just those few bad apples. And speaking of bad apples, there's one that I'm not afraid to just talk about, and that's Jay Houghton. Mountain up in the Mexico area. He had a bill yesterday that had a hearing that would disallow any children under 6 years old from hunting and disallow anybody under the age of 15 from hunting alone without being in the proximity of a licensed hunter education educated instructor. So now you're back in 1950, Joel, in Dalton, and you can't go out on the family farm and hunt anymore.
Yeah, that's harassment. That's all it is. It's just, it's just picking on people that can't fight back when you're, you know, take on six-year-olds.
Yeah, I didn't grow up in a hunting or fishing family. And if I had had to have an adult with me to do those things, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Same with me.
I never would have started hunting.
You know, for me, it was the ability to walk the farms around the house after I got off the school bus before I could drive. And that bill would have kept me from becoming a hunter. And maybe that's the goal. I mean, this is the same guy that wants to turn the Katy Trail, one of America's premier state parks, into an ATV track, is the self-proclaimed hero of the captive deer industry, is trying to change the number of commissioners on the commission and regionalize it. I mean, the list goes on and on and on about all the things this guy throws against the wall trying to hurt conservation in this state. Yet he's in Callaway County and part of the state that might be some of the best hunting we have.
Yeah. Well, what is there about Mexico? I spent 10 years up there as a sports editor on the Mexico Ledger, and it just seems like one legislator after another comes from Mexico and tries to do away with the conservation department.
I don't know. I'm the outdoor writer for the Mexico Ledger now, though.
Are you really?
Yeah.
They did away with it for quite a while.
Yeah.
We've got a little bit of inbreeding going on here. When Joel left the conservation department, I took his place. You're doing his job at the Mexico Ledger.
Yeah. Yeah, I've spread my column to about 25 newspapers a week now.
Well, you know, that's probably the reason I got my job at the conservation department was I was really the sports editor, you know, but I kept doing features on hunting and fishing because that's what I like to do. I did a series on water pollution in the Mexico area and tried to regionalize it or localize it, and it caught the attention of Jim Keefe, who was at that time the head of the, we called it the information section, which I don't know what it is now. It's changed names several times. But anyway, caught his attention, and he contacted me and asked me if I was interested in working for the conservation department. And I, at that time, had been looking around trying to get a job as a sports editor on various small newspapers up in Minnesota, Wisconsin. I had applied here and there, and I found out that when you apply for a job as an outdoor editor on a small daily, you're fighting some guy that's been there for about 40 years or somebody that's been there for 35 years waiting for the other one to die or retire, and they just aren't available. So I told Jim, I said, yeah, I think I'm interested after all. And I took the job, and I was there for 21 happy years.
At least that was a time, though, where outdoor communication was prevalent in newspapers. You know, unfortunately, today we're seeing such a drastic decline of conservation coverage. And I wrote a column this week talking about how many more times can you read a story about the pre-rut or the post-spawn or hunting mushrooms? Like, when are we actually going to get into some political, heavy conservation topics? There's just not many of those guys left. Brent Frazee just retired from the Kansas City Star. He's not getting replaced. Post-Dispatch doesn't have an outdoor column anymore. You know, I think of Paul Smith up in Milwaukee, but I can't name too many more full-time outdoor journalists in America.
Yeah, there are. Some of them are out west. Rich Landers at Spokane and Bill Monroe was at Portland or Oregonian. I think there still are some out west, but not so many in this part of the country.
Why do you think the...
I don't know.
The industry's changing so much.
I don't know. I think part of it is newspapers are fading away, especially the metropolitan dailies are just failing, and they're being replaced by the internet and podcasts and things like that.
Yeah. And when they start doing budget cuts and reductions in force, outdoor writers are considered luxuries, and they're the first to go.
And it is good. You know, you mentioned the podcast, kind of tongue in cheek, what we're doing right now. But the fact of the matter is there's new communication methods. The problem with that is there's no fact checking on those. Nobody's going to check our facts on this podcast. Yeah. The current cover of Time Magazine asks the question, is truth dead? And scary that we're in a situation right now where we have to seriously consider that. Like, what are the bounds of media? Where does media and journalism collide?
Well, apparently now we have alternative facts. That's the buzzword today.
And how scary is that?
Well, that's frightening. It's frightening to anybody that grew up in journalism.
Right. I mean, you're just seeing a total shift in the industry where anybody that has a Facebook account thinks they're a journalist now. Everybody gets on Facebook and rants and raves and comes up with something that they believe to be true or would like to see true, and they tend to try to make it that
way.
Well,
I put in a plug for my website, joelvance.com, where I blog, and I, you know, any blog that I write that's political, and I write quite a few of them, I check every fact. I'm not about to lie. I fulminate and bloviate and whatever, but I don't lie.
Right. Well, and that's it. When you have journalistic ethics like that, it's hard to fight against alternative facts, otherwise known as lies, because on the face of it, people don't necessarily know the difference between what Joel carefully researched and what somebody else made up.
We just came from a conference in Nashville, a chronic wasting disease conference. Some of the great scientific minds that have studied this disease for the last 10, 20 years. And the basic culmination of that conference was, we have to stop fighting with science. And I mean, it's just heartbreaking to think that we can't take facts and science to the public and to politics and expect to win with that. Because the people on the other side of the fence, pun intended, are not dealing in facts and science. They're dealing in emotion and opinions.
Yeah.
And that's crushing this fact-based argument that we're trying to work
with. That's why Missourians took conservation out of politics 80 years ago. And that's why we still have to fight today to keep it that way. Because there are people in the legislature who would very much like to change that. They'd like to repoliticize and take the science out of conservation. And they try every year. And that's why why the Conservation Federation and its work is so important. Chronic wasting disease is a perfect case in point. There are moves in the legislature currently and have been for several years to water down the Conservation Department's authority to regulate captive deer and to regulate the transportation of those deer, which is what is spreading chronic wasting disease around the nation and the world. And, you know, if something isn't done quickly to stop the spread of that disease, it will devastate Missouri's deer herd and traditions and the economic benefits of that deer herd.
So I lectured a conservation policy class at Mizzou yesterday, and it was a great class. Upperclassmen, a lot of graduate students, older undergraduate students. And at the end, they were really engaged. And one of them said, I heard that deer breeder industry was paying politicians.
Well,
I said, well, technically they're not paying them, but every politician that had an R next to their name was getting $500 campaign contributions. And then the questions just started flowing like water in a river. And I explained to these students really what's going on, like what a campaign contribution is and how the hierarchy of the legislature works. You know, when you're a freshman, you kind of get in line with what the party tells you to do, unless you're a real anomaly. Man, just seeing these kids start soaking in some of the realities of what's going on, it was an interesting lesson for them,
you know,
for sure.
It's depressing in a way. I've seen it happen the way that power corrupts, because when a freshman legislator comes in, always bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and wants to do the right thing, if they're there long enough, almost inevitably, they become saturated by whatever, campaign contributions or the necessity to get reelected or power hungriness or whatever it is, and they are corrupted. And I've seen it happen, and I won't mention a name, but a former governor of Missouri, came in as one of the best we've ever had, interested in conservation, dedicated to it, in every way was supportive, came over and visited the conservation department and came around, talked to all of us, you know, and was just the best guy that ever was. First term was wonderful. He was reelected. His second term was somewhat less. Ran for the Senate, got elected, and was reelected a couple of times and finally retired. And by the time he was done, he was, I hate to say it, just a bloated old politician.
And that's just party politics. And I think my generation, and especially the generations under me, maybe it's wishful thinking, maybe I'm being wishful, but I just think we're not going to adhere to party politics the way that it has gone for the last few generations. And if you look at not just Missouri, but the national votes or any other state, I mean, it is so party lines. It's just disappointing. Yeah. You know, like you said, these guys come in, guys and gals come in with ideas of what they want to do, but essentially they're whipped into line. And when you have exact party votes, you know, not everybody in that party feels they're doing the right thing either way, but yet they just do it based on party affiliation. And all of that is based on who you're going to get money from the next time you're trying to get reelected.
Well, you know, when the Supreme Court okayed Citizens United, which made basically corporations people and took the limits off of campaign contributions, it opened the floodgate. Now money rules more than it ever has in the history of the country. And, you know, if you don't get the big bucks, you don't get elected or you don't get reelected. And so everybody's out trying to raise more money than the other guy. And this crosses party lines. It's not just Democrat or Republican. This is everybody. They have the same hurdle to try and get over to get more money and so they can buy the ads and get reelected. And it's just not good for the country unless we can somehow get rid of this emphasis on campaign contributions. We're never going to get better, I don't think.
Lately, I have thought several times of one of the inscriptions in our state capitol building, and I believe that it's pretty close to it is to say, where there is no vision, the people perish. And this discussion that we're having about the influence of money on politics, it removes the vision from the lawmaking process. It makes it all about power and all about winning elections, and people don't vote their consciences. That's the vision part. That's where legislators should be following a vision, and they're not. And the results will be long-term devastating.
And it's extremely important that they follow their conscience, but also the conscience of their constituents. And it's the constituency's fault for not forcing their conscience on those elected officials. Yeah. If you don't know who your state representative is, then you certainly don't know what they're doing in Jefferson City. Yeah. You go in and you vote for a Republican or you vote for a Democrat or you recognize a name and you pull the lever on that one. If you don't know who these people are and you don't know what they're doing, then shame on you for allowing this discord to happen on your watch.
Yeah. You get the government you deserve.
But that's the whole point of the money game, is to gain, to buy name recognition. The more money you get, the more you can spend to have ads and television ads and whatever, and get your name in front of the public more often than the other guy. And the one that manages to do that is generally the one that gets to get elected, because the people go into the polling booth and they see a name that they've seen on television and they pull the lever.
Right. All right, we're going to spin out of this political talk and get back to riding a little. I'm sitting here staring at Jim's Outdoor Writers Association of America badge on his shirt. And, you know, all three of us are members of that organization as outdoor communicators. But I think you're really, Joel, in that category. Are you officially a legendary communicator at this point?
I don't think so.
I'll speak for Joel. He's officially a legend.
Officially, yeah. No,
well, I don't know. We have a...
Like, there's things named after you.
I don't think so.
Isn't there like a scholarship or an award named after Joel yet?
I've done a lot of work for the John Madsen Scholarship Fellowship, but as far as anything named for me, they know better than that. No, I've made too much trouble.
It's a bad idea to name things after people who are still alive.
Yeah, and I hope that I still am. I think I am. I was this morning anyway.
Yeah, but how long have you been in OWA?
And well, how'd let's you get see, I start? Joined in 1967. I think maybe 67 or 68, and was sponsored in and been there ever since. And I've, at one time or another, I think I've known, met, or been friends with most of the legendary outdoor communicators in the country. I mean, people who, at one time anyway, were, you know, you'd see them on TV with their own television shows or see them on the wide world of sports or whatever. And they're, I'm proud to have known them.
Yeah, there's a quote, and I won't get it exactly right, but Kris Kristofferson once said something along the lines of, I can't believe that my heroes have become my friends.
Yeah, well, that's the way I feel.
And I feel that way, too, you know, sitting here with you today, and really because of those organizations. I'm currently the president of the Association of Great Lakes Outdoor Riders and really enjoy that. And growing up in the Chicago area, I grew up in the Chicago area too. So a lot of the Midwest outdoors and a very heavy Wisconsin and Minnesota kind of influence through Al Linder and Babe Winkleman and, mm-hmm. and those kind of early pioneers
Went
of television.
With Babe one time.
Yeah. I heard he's an interesting guy to hang out with.
He is an authentic character, believe me.
He is an authentic character, and he's also, he's got principles.
Yes.
When he makes a mistake, he owns up to it. When he sees an issue that needs to be spoken out about, he speaks out. And if it costs him financially, well, he lets those cards fall where they may. I admire Babe Winkleman.
Those guys were kind of my early heroes. So when I was a kid, I grew up right before the cable television explosion. So it was Channel 38, Christian UHF channel out of Chicago. And fishing shows would start at 5:30 in the morning. I'd stay the night at Grandpa's house on Friday night, and we'd get up and he'd make breakfast and we'd watch fishing shows from 5:30 to 10. And it was N Fisherman, Bill Dance, Babe Winkleman, Ted Takasaki.
Just fish with him.
A number of these guys that are, you know, still around. And now I've gotten to meet them and know them. And it's a pretty cool
I can say
experience.
That I fished with Ted Takasaki and he didn't catch a damn fish.
Did you?
No. Neither one of us did. But the thing is, this shows you the professional and the not professional. When we got through with the day, for the day, it was cold and we were tired and hungry. The other two guys and I went back to the motel and got something to eat. Ted went back out fishing.
That's awesome. Yeah, so, you know, all the time people ask, you know, how do you get into being an outdoor writer? How do you get into, you know, the outdoor communication industry? And I would advise people to look into these organizations. You know, here in Missouri, we have the Missouri Outdoor Communicators. There's a couple good regional organizations, AGLO that I just mentioned, and the Southeastern Outdoor Press Association. And then, you know, the National Outdoor Writers Association of America and the Professional Outdoor Media Association.
Yeah, the local groups, the state groups are great places to begin that process and meet working writers and video producers and, you know, everybody in this field now that is so much more diverse than just writing to advance your knowledge of the craft. And then as you progress, the national organizations, like Joel mentioned, they offer you opportunities to meet your idols and to learn from them and learn with them. And the fellowship that comes out of those groups is for me, the best thing about them. I've learned a lot from the Outdoor Writers Association, but the thing I treasure most is the friendships.
Yeah, my best friends live all over the country, you know, and I see them once or twice a year, usually at these events. And if we are fortunate enough to go fishing or hunting once throughout the year, it's, as you get older, I guess you really start gravitating towards people more with similar interests, not just similar geography.
Yeah, you know, I learned something too pretty early on the Outdoor Writers Association. Going to the annual conference, there's always what they call a green ribbon meeting. The green ribbon people, members, are there for the first time. They wear a little green ribbon in their lapel or whatever on their name tag. And when the conference is over, they get to take that off, and then they're full-fledged members. And invariably, at the many conferences I went to early on, Homer Circle, who is a legend in fishing, was a legend then. He would always make a point of going to the Green Ribbon meeting. Didn't have to, you know, but he wanted to because these were newcomers. He wanted to greet them personally, talk to them. And this was like, you know, having Jesus come into church and sit in the pew with you and talk to you. And that's what he did because he felt that was part of his duty as an outdoor communicator was to make these people feel welcome. And I kind of learned from that because I started doing that too when Homer got too old to go anymore and didn't want to go. So I'd do that, and I urged other people to go and make these people feel welcome.
Yeah, and another very special OWA member and a past president was Spencer Turner. Yeah. And unfortunately, most people listening know that we've lost Spence recently, and all of us knew him, but you guys had a really special relationship.
Spence and I met in the first, we had an orientation class 1969 when we both started working for the Conservation Department, and we were both in the orientation class, and we had a break, started talking, and I introduced myself, and I said, "Where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Wisconsin originally." And I said, "Well, my mom was from Wisconsin. What town?" He said, "Rice Lake." And I said, "My mom was from 18 miles away in Birchwood." So we were immediately bonded. And over the years, Spence and I probably traveled many thousands of miles, many hundreds of hours together. We hunted, we fished. I was with him in most of the many, many, many mishaps he's had. And I once told him that if we ever lost him, well, I would lose half the writing material that I had, because Spence was his own worst enemy in many ways. He had a penchant for getting into trouble, but it was always humorous. And he was just my best buddy for 40 years.
So whenever I bring his name up, it's rare that your name doesn't come up alongside of. When we're talking Spence Turner, Joel Vance always comes up.
Yeah, well, we sank a boat together.
It's the mishaps that everybody talks about and remembers. Like, you guys are famous for sinking a boat.
Yeah.
Tell us a few more of these.
Tell them the bird dog stories.
Oh, well, it takes a while, but it borders on the, not obscene.
Pornographic?
Well, sort of, in a way. Anyway, Spence had a setter that he was very proud of, and she'd been in heat. And he took her to the vet, and she had a shot that was supposed to defuse her. And I had a very lusty Brittany, and a male dog. And we, at that time, my wife, Marty, had gone out not too awful long before and came home with a Mercedes following her. It was an old, beat-up one, but it was still a Mercedes, pretty elegant car. So we decided we would go grouse hunting up in northeast Iowa, first time we'd ever been grouse hunting. And we took the two dogs with us, and allegedly Samantha, Spence's setter, was defused. And the two dogs got along fine in the back seat of this elegant car. We got up to northeast Iowa, and we hunted all day, hunted hard. We didn't get any grouse, but we had a good time. The dogs performed very well, very friendly toward each other, no untoward moves. And we decided that we deserved a good meal out. So we stopped somewhere and asked the people, local people, where's the best place in town to eat? They said, well, there's a supper club out on highway, whatever it is. It's a dinner theater, but you can get a meal there too. So we went out there and we went into the restaurant. We were still wearing our hunting clothes with bloody, pants on, hunting pants and shirts and everything. We left the two dogs in the back seat of the Mercedes. So we're sitting by a window, and the waitress came over to get an order from us, and she looked out the window, and she said, are those dogs out there? And I didn't even have to look. I knew what had happened before I even turned around and looked. The two dogs had fallen in love in the back seat of this Mercedes, and about that same time, cars began to come into the parking lot, all these elegant Lincolns and Chryslers and big cars, and I don't know what the play was that night that these people were arriving for, but it must have been appeal to the geriatric set, because from each car came these old ladies, gray-haired, blue-haired, and dressed to the nines, and they were ready to go to see the play. And they would each stop, and they would peer over at this equally elegant Mercedes sitting there, and they'd start toward it, and I would watch them, and they'd get about halfway there, and then I'd see them go, oh, and they'd turn around and totter back into the... I've told the story many, many times, but...
Well, wasn't there also an incident that involved a parade?
Oh, yeah. Well, that wasn't Spence, though. That was... Actually, that was one of our foresters and one of our biologists. Gene Kelly, and I'll give the names even. Gene Kelly was a wildlife biologist who had a male Labrador. Mickey Kimberlin was a forester over at Steelville. And Gene was stationed down at Rolla. And they wanted to get their two labs together and have puppies. And Gene, Mickey's female, came in heat. And Gene was going to take his male lab over to Steelville, where Mickey was stationed, and get the two dogs together and result in puppies. So he started out, and was on a Saturday afternoon, started out with his male lab in the back of a conservation department pickup. It was an open pickup bed with the triangle placard on the door. And he got as far as St. James, the forest city of the Ozarks, and he started through town, and he got into town, and he had picked up Mickey's dog. The two dogs were in the back of the pickup truck as he started into St. James, headed back toward Mickey's house. And he got just started into St. James, and he suddenly realized this wasn't a normal Saturday morning. There was a lot of traffic, and he looked behind him, and there were, looked like floats or something back there.
Probably a marching band, too.
Yeah, something. Could have been, I don't know what, all kinds of things, you know. And he looked in front of him, and there were, like, implement dealers. And he suddenly realized he was in a parade. And he looked to the side. He didn't want to be in a parade with these dogs in the back end, because he glanced in the rearview mirror, and the dogs had fallen desperately in love and were involved in mating back there in a conservation department truck in the back of his, you know, of his pickup. And he looked to the side, trying to get off to a side street. They were all blockaded off so they could have this parade right through the middle of town. And they're still, to this day, talking about the utterly unique conservation department float.
All right. I think that's enough on dogs falling in love. So you, as a communicator, had the opportunity to go all across Missouri and tell the stories of hunting and fishing and all aspects of conservation, probably saw corners of this state that many people never will. What are some of the places that stand out to you? What are some of your favorite locations, and what do you do when you get there?
Well, I remember going up to Rockport one time. We used to go up there, several of us, Bill Bennett, who was the outdoor editor at the St. Joe paper, and another friend and I would go up and we'd hunt pheasants, which was one of the few places in Missouri where you could hunt them. We'd go up to Rockport and hunt pheasants and generally go through Squaw Creek, a National Wildlife Refuge, and look for critters and whatever. And I loved it up there. That was just really neat. I remember one time we camped at, I can't remember the name of the wildlife area. We camped out, and Bill invited a hound dog. It was started to sleet and snow. And this old hound came and poked its nose inside the tent. And Bill said, "Oh, come on in." This smelly old hound, a terrible old thing, came in the tent with us and spent half the night with us. And I remember that particularly well because of that. But at one time or another, I think I've been in every corner of the state. And that was one of my memories that I remember really well, because Bill, like so many of my friends, is gone now.
Yeah, for me, I think what stands out and makes Missouri so special are the rivers. I just love moving water, and having lived out west for a few years and experiencing the Rocky Mountain rivers in Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, just not thinking there could be anything comparable in the country. And some of the rivers that we have in Missouri are comparable.
Well, I mean, they are.
Very comparable.
Yeah.
Current, the North Fork, the Jack's Fork. Do you have any good stories from spending time on some of our Ozark rivers?
Well, our kids have all grown up on the Ozark rivers. They camped on them. Our son Andy, who's sitting over on the couch, one time got trapped under a tent down on the Jack's Fork in a violent thunderstorm. The tent came down on top of him, and we all crawled out of the tent. It was a big tent, so there were like seven or eight people sleeping in it. We all crawled out, got out, and got a flashlight on and counted noses. We were missing one, and Andy was like maybe 4.5, 5 years old at the time, and we realized it was him. And we took the tent down and to reset it. He was underneath the tent, and it collapsed on him. He didn't even know it. all this time. I didn't even wake up.
Well, you look like you're in pretty good shape. I mean, you're looking good and physically fit, but there's probably an outdoor adventure that you'd hope to make in your lifetime that probably is off the list at this point. What's something that you would have liked to have done somewhere in the world, probably aren't going to get around to getting done?
I don't know. I really can't think of anything that I haven't done that I really wanted to do. I know Jim went to Alaska a year or so ago to the Outdoor Writers Conference, and I would like to have gone up there and fished, but I can get along without that because I've done the equivalent here in the lower 48 and caught up. We talked about Spence Turner. I fished for king salmon out in Oregon, and I caught a 28-pounder, I think, and Spence was behind us quite a ways, and I had mine up on the bank, and I was looking at it and admiring it, and Spence came along, and he held up a 26-pounder, and he went, "Oh, look at this," and he was rubbing it in really big time, and I said, "Ah, look at this," and I held mine up, and it was 2 pounds heavier. I never let him forget that.
But you never made it to Alaska.
No. Well, yeah, I did. We took a cruise, but I never fished up there. No. Yeah,
I've yet to make it to Alaska. I'm kind of scared to go. I have this tendency to move to places that I enjoy visiting a lot. It happened in Colorado, happened in Montana, and happened in Missouri. So I'm trying not to go to Alaska because I got a feeling I might end up living there someday for a while.
Well, that's the last promised land, you know. But
It is a wild, wild place. If you are inclined to be hooked by the wild, that is the place to go.
Well, we're closing in on an hour. We've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to talk to you about some of your books. I get your emails all the time saying, "Buy my books." So let's talk about some
Nobody ever does.
Well, maybe this will help.
You're welcome to try.
I'm going to buy one before we leave today. So you're going to get at least one sale out of this podcast for sure. But maybe somebody listening would like to have some of Joel's books for their library. So what was the first book you wrote?
Oh, the first one was Grandma and the Buck Deer, which was way back in 1969, I want to say. Somewhere way back when. And it was a group of short stories that I enjoyed writing. And since then, I've written, I don't know how many books, quite a few, 8 or 10 maybe.
And somewhere in that 8 or 10, there's a series. Is that correct? There's a series of books that are all loosely based on the same characters? Or
well, pretty much, yeah. The grandma introduced the characters, and I have since grown them up into a couple of different books. If anybody's interested in my books, I've got a website, joelvance.com. They can find out about them there, and it lists all the books and prices, and I'd be more than happy for people to buy them.
Well, tell us a little bit more information about a couple of your favorite books that you've done.
Well, I wrote one, a series of ghost stories,
that were excellent.
Called Autumn Shadows. And I don't know, I guess every kid grows up, you know, being interested by ghost stories, going to spooky movies and whatever. And I just started writing these stories, and before long I had a book. And I found a publisher, and it was fun.
That's one of my favorites. Another of my favorites is Confessions of an Outdoor Maladroit. Do you still have that book to sell?
I still have that. A few of them, I think.
That's a classic.
Well, if you say so.
Well, one book that's definitely found its place in Missouri's history of outdoor books is Save the Last Dance. And Knopp being the photographer. And what was your role? You're involved in that book.
Yeah, I was and I wasn't. I mean, Knopp et al. Pauthong's photos are the book. And the guy is a fantastic wildlife photographer. And I wrote the copy for it. But that's all I can't say that it's my book. It's really Knopp's book. And I would recommend it to everybody because it's a lovely, lovely book. And it took, I think, second place in the national competition, not because of my writing, but because of his wonderful photography.
Well, photography that good deserves writing like yours to accompany it, so I'm sure everybody will appreciate the words that go with the images. You are correct. The photography is absolutely phenomenal.
Just stunning.
Yeah, and Knopp, of course, is a Department of Conservation photographer now. Another thing I didn't mention earlier that I wanted to, and both of you guys being writers for The Conservationist, is for anybody that's listening that doesn't get The Conservationist, I want to make sure you know that it's free. This is an incredible conservation magazine put out by the Department of Conservation that is free for all residents of Missouri to receive. And that's just another benefit of the Design for Conservation sales tax.
And a way for the Conservation Department to keep its constituents up to date on what it's doing.
And not only what it's doing, but what you can do in the outdoors as well. Every issue has different stories about where you can go and what you can do to participate in the outdoors in Missouri. So the fact that I think the circulation is close to 600,000 families across the state get The Conservationist in their mailbox every month, giving information about what's going on in the outdoors, what you can do in the outdoors. And, you know, legendary communicators like Joel Vance and Jim Lowe have graced those pages for many 40 years. 40 years. So.
45.
45.
Okay. Well, as we close this out, Joel, I just would like to ask you to give some sage advice. What do you have an audience here listening? What would you like to say to people coming up in conservation today to help carry on the legacy of those biologists you were talking about and communicators like yourself?
Well, I think that everybody, every citizen of the state has a stake in the outdoors because it is, in my mind, the number one conservation state in the country and has been for many years. And I think it's almost a duty of every kid growing up, even in the city or country, doesn't matter where, to get educated about the outdoors. There are great education programs that the Conservation Department has about wildlife. Learn about the outdoors and just become interested, read about it. You know, when I was a kid growing up in Chicago, my favorite authors were, writers like Jack London or people that wrote about outdoor things, outdoor adventures. And I think those things are still available if kids get themselves interested.
Anything to add, Jim?
Oh, what is it? Eternal vigilance is the price of freedom or whatever? You know, there's a tendency to think that because we've had it for 80 years now that we'll always have a great conservation department. And that is not necessarily true. You need to pay attention to what's going on in the legislature. The best way to do that is to become a Conservation Federation member. They will keep you up to date on what's going on with conservation in the state and give you opportunities to express your support for conservation. If we lose the land and the things that live on the land, nothing else really matters. And it's important. Missouri has a strong history of citizen involvement in conservation. Everybody needs to be a part of that.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you, Brandon.